Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The voices of women continue to resonate in American politics, business, and the entertainment industry. But are women speaking out about how they are represented in medical research? The FDA has launched a Diverse Women in Clinical Trials campaign. Joining me now is Laura Black. She's Senior Director of Clinical Research at Sanford Health, and she's with me in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Let's start with, for folks who are tuning in, and they say, I've always wanted to know what exactly a clinical trial is. Let's get real basic, and you know, what are we talking about? Let's lay the groundwork.
Sure. Clinical trials are essentially the testing of new therapies, so it could be drugs or devices, behavioral interventions, in a specific disease to understand if it's better than what we're currently doing. So it's really the way that we advance medicine and find new discoveries that work within a larger population.
All right. So how are women represented now in clinical trials? Do we have numbers? Do we have an idea of, you know, how much research is being done with men as participants versus women?
So in terms of our specific data, we haven't pulled that necessarily. I think that's probably on the horizon for us to make sure that we're including women. But there's been, since the early 90s, a very dedicated effort to include women and minorities in clinical research for the very reasons that we're going to talk about today. But I think there's been, it's 25 years, we're kind of rekindling what it looks like to include those women, knowing that there's been instances in that last 25 years that have solidified for us why we need to be not only including women in clinical research, but also reporting out the data by gender and really looking at some of the pieces that way that maybe aren't so obvious on the surface, even if women are participating.
25 years of what?
So 25 years is when the FDA basically said they lifted a moratorium on pregnant and childbearing women of childbearing potential being in clinical trials. So that was really only, it's not that long ago if we think about it. So now we're 25 years into this and recognizing that we're including the women, but are we looking at the data in the appropriate way and encouraging more and more women?
Why does it matter?
This is a good question, and I think it's a little bit tough for all of us to think about in the climate that we're in. But it's really important from a biological basis because women and men are very different down to the cellular level. So when we think about the organs that women have, the hormones that women have, all of those things interplay in the way that medicines are metabolized, in the way that they maybe react to different anesthesia. There's all of these different reasons that we don't really fully understand yet that can affect not only how well it works, but then do women have side effects. So perhaps do they have more severe side effects than men because they metabolize the drug differently? Some of that can even be based on body composition. So we know women tend to have more body fat than men, and that all can affect drug absorption and metabolism.
So how much are we seeing the differences, you know, really impact us? Are we seeing, you know, is this sort of an academic conversation, or is this something that's unfolding as women are actually, being treated, you know, for things and finding out that those treatments don't necessarily
It's a constant state of learning. One of the examples that I think really brings home the point is Ambien. Most people know of Ambien. So when we think of that,
sleep medication.
Sleep medication, right? Okay. Yep. So a sleep aid, and there's a lot of folks on Ambien and other agents with the same active ingredient. And even just as recent as 4 years ago, there was enough data to say, you know, women only need to take half of what men need to take. And that was found by some of these things with the morning after kind of fogginess, impaired driving, those sorts of things. So that's really brought it to the forefront to say we have to think about this outside of not just preclinical research, which is, you know, how we do animal studies, and not in the earliest stages of clinical research when we're designing the studies, but also in how we're really evaluating the data and looking at it side by side, men versus women.
So can we go back to studies that have already, been completed and reevaluate, or is this something that we have to start with clinical studies that are, you know, being initiated or planned now?
Ideally, the data sets would be robust enough that we can go back and at least get somewhat of an indication if there's a signal there that we need to be worried about. So it'll be interesting to see as the FDA ramps up this new program if there's a call for funding to go back and look at some of those data sets that we've collected over the last 25 years.
So this is interesting, as the FDA is saying, you know, really, a marketing campaign saying women, diverse women, women of all, different backgrounds need to come forward and participate in clinical trials. Has that ever happened before, where there's been a push to really educate people in your memory? I mean, you sure. can't say ever.
Sure,
but, yeah.
sure. You know, I, as long as I've been in research, there's always been the push to include women and minorities. It was always something that we had to report to the federal government and explain what we were doing for efforts. But I don't think to this level of really helping the public understand why it's important, more than just, you know, we need equal representation, the biological reasons for it and the implications, that's new.
All right. So just to be clear, when we talk about equal representation, we're not necessarily talking about, like, you know, a breast cancer study, which would impact, you know, or an ovarian cancer study, which would really only impact women, versus, you know, heart disease, which could impact women and men differently, or the treatments for. Am I on the right path
yes,
here?
Yes, heart disease, okay. Alzheimer's, cholesterol lowering drugs, really anything you can think of that you would get a prescription for or have a device implanted. Those are all of the things that we need minorities and women represented. Right. Within those studies.
So what do I need to know as a patient or as a potential participant in a clinical trial? You know, what sort of research and steps do I need to take to sort of find what's available and then decide whether I want to participate?
That's a really good question. So it's always a good idea to start with your physician. They generally have an idea of if you're a candidate for open trials. They can help you walk through the appropriate steps if you have questions about what a clinical trial entails. You can also look on the website. We do have clinical trials listed on our Sanford website. You just search into the search box, clinical trials. Or there's lots of other places on the web. If you really, really want to be involved, you can find studies at nearly every healthcare institution. And should you find a trial that you think you might be interested in, it's really getting the information about what they're studying, how long you'll be in the study, what are the risks, what are some of the side effects, those types of things, and then making sure that you understand that it's always voluntary. So that's one thing we like to drive home with our clinical trial patients, is that these are volunteers, and we really look at them as medical volunteers. And at any point in time, should you decide to join a clinical study and it doesn't feel right, or there, you've changed your mind, then you can certainly withdraw from the study. So I think that's one of the things I like to make sure and drive home for everyone.
How do you evaluate when we start talking about doing it? You know, if I look on Sanford's website, I kind of know what I'm getting. If I broaden my web search, I could get in some funky territory
pretty quickly. You could.
So how do you evaluate a clinical study that is worth, you know,
participating in? And I think that's very true, not to get, you know, off the rails here, but when we think about regenerative medicine and stem cells and the things that are happening in that space,
right.
There are a lot of interventions that are being disguised as clinical research studies, but really truly aren't. So that's where I think having contact with your physician and having them really vet out the institution, the provider, the treatment.
What are they if they're not actual? What are they?
Well, unfortunately, they market themselves as clinical trials, but it's really a pay-for-service.
Sure.
Or maybe they're gathering some data. So as a general rule, if someone asks you to participate in a clinical trial and they want to charge you a lot of money, that's a big red flag. So that's, I think, where I would probably start. And then really working with your physician, family, friends, having an educated conversation with the people that are in your network to help them vet things out, especially if it's something for a serious disease. Sometimes we get a little bit clouded in our judgment, and so it's good to have that social support network help you vet those out.
All right. So always go back to your physician again and again. We'll say that probably, you know, several more times. Can you tell from, you know, what kind of information can you get about the study before you go in, as far as what all is it going
sure.
to entail?
So the best website is actually a government-run website. It's clinicaltrials.gov. And what that has on there is any study that meets specific federal criteria must be listed there. And it will tell you what the intervention is. It will tell you if you're randomized or not. So do you get to pick what arm you're in, or does the study randomize you? It's basically like flipping a coin. What are the general criteria you need to be in the study? So any other health conditions that you have, sometimes there's age limitations, other medication limitations, that will all be listed there. And then it will also have a general idea of how many times you'll need to return for the study. So when you're thinking about, can I afford to be away from work, or can I find transportation? A lot of those details are listed there. And then most importantly, the contact for the study where you can get more information.
How long do they typically go? Is that just vary so much?
It varies so much. It can be, sometimes device studies last for 30 days after the device is implanted. We have cancer studies that are still going 25 years after the patient's been treated. So it really depends on what we're looking for and the disease state.
Interesting. How about at Sanford? Are there any clinical studies that you're looking, actively seeking patients for, that you wanted to talk about? Or is that something, just go to the website and
We're always seeking patients. Yes, sure. I think one thing about Sanford, and we've tried hard to educate the community, and I think that goes back, whether it's men, women, you know, children, whatever it might be, really working hard for people to understand what the options are. We have trials, over 350 of them at any given time, that are in all of our different clinics. So definitely, check them out. Most all of them are for diagnosed conditions. We do have a few that are healthy population studies where we're maybe doing like an Ebola vaccine. We did that one a few years ago. So there are opportunities for people who are well, but certainly if you have any medical condition, you can check out what we have open on the website.
How do you think about privacy and think about maintaining your privacy when you go into a clinical trial? Because you're opening yourself up at some point to more than you would with just a physician's appointment.
Sure, absolutely. And that's one of the paramount things. One of our duties to our research subjects is privacy and confidentiality. So any legitimate study will walk through with you who has access to your data, what will be stored within your medical record. As we enter the era of genomic and genetic research, it's good to be educated about what will be in your medical record there. And again, any informed consent form, which is what you really want to study if you're thinking about participating, should walk through, again, all of those privacy and confidentiality concerns.
Is this mostly an altruistic thing to do, where you're sort of doing this for the good of humanity, or do patients in clinical studies or do participants ever really end up benefiting directly from, you have a chronic condition, or you have cancer, or you have something, and does it happen fast enough to where you might actually benefit from what's discovered during the trial?
So this is a really interesting question, and one of the research questions that a group of us within a state cancer coalition tried to answer a few years ago. And I think the answer is really varied based on geographic region. It's based on generation. It's based on what the treatment indication is for the study. But generally, it's altruism mixed with the hope for some personal benefit.
And maybe some to your family, if
absolutely.
It's a genetic. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it was Frontline or Nova who did an Alzheimer's, and they found the research story and found a family who just, everyone in the family had early onset Alzheimer's, and the entire family was participating in whatever they could in the hopes that the people who came after them would benefit from it. Interesting.
Exactly. Yeah.
What else do we need to cover here? Insurance, is this something that in the world of health insurance, which we're all slightly confused about almost on a daily basis, does this impact that for us? Is it a question that we end up calling our insurance company and saying, this is what I'm looking to do?
I would encourage everyone to do that. At Sanford, we do often check with insurance before we enroll someone on clinical trial. There is federal legislation under the Affordable Care Act that requires all providers to allow for clinical trial inclusion as long as they're not a grandfathered plan, which is a bunch of mumbo jumbo for how old the insurance plan is. But there are some federal regulations to really protect patients' rights to be in clinical trials. So certainly I would ask again your provider, and then, you know, you can always call your insurance company. Or if you're at an institution where you're working with a research coordinator, which often you are, and they're really the ones that are facilitating you enrolling in a study, make sure and ask them, because they'll know what the best way is to get you that answer.
In South Dakota, you know, being a place that has, you know, great geographic distance, sometimes when you talk about, you know, getting transportation and making sure that you can participate fully, is that something that research scientists in the state are trying to overcome and solve? Do you, you know, often pay for transportation or to increase, you know, with the desire Absolutely. Of increasing diversity in the trial?
Right. So making sure that the compensation is appropriate with the travel, we do try and provide mileage stipends, hotel stipends, those types of things. And all of that is carefully evaluated by our ethics committee so that we're not unduly influencing anyone by compensating them to participate. But we Right. very much always consider those things when we're looking at clinical trials. And then beyond that, I think being creative as far as how we can actually get trials to people in their communities. So can we utilize telemedicine? Can we utilize some of the technology solutions that we have at our fingertips to really help people be treated where they are?
What other ethics challenges do we look at as participants that we say, you know, how do I know, what are those red flags? We talked about, you know, a large amount of money that they're seeking from you or whatever. What else are we looking for to sort of steer ourselves away from?
Sure. I think any study site who pressures you to be involved or wants you to make a hasty decision, a mm-hmm. quick decision, those are things I would look out for. Again, making sure that they're not asking for large sums of money, and that most importantly, you're getting that informed consent. And you'll know that you're getting one because they're generally pretty long. We kind of liken it to signing all of your mortgage paperwork. It's about, you know, anywhere between 15 and 30 pages. And so that outlines your rights and making sure that you get that and that you understand what's in there. And those will go through some of the ethics challenges or the things that are involved in the informed consent specifically address some of the ethical challenges that we've dealt with in the past.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And talk to your doctor. Start there.
Talk to your doctor.
Laura Black is Senior Director of Clinical Research at Sanford Health. Laura, anything, any final thoughts? Do we cover everything?
I think we covered most everything. Certainly check out the website and lots of good resources about what clinical trials are. So be educated.
Be educated. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate the part of the education here.
Thank you.